Good evening, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to part three of Rounds with the Investigators. As tonight, we'll be working with our distinguished faculty and hearing about cases from their practices and do what we always like to do with Research to Practice, which is make rounds and ask them tough questions. We have a great faculty tonight, Dr. Ian Kropp from the Yale Cancer Center, Dr. Sarah Tulaney from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Dr. Kevin Kalinske from the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University, Dr. Joyce O'Shaughnessy from the Baylor University Medical Center and the Sarah Cannon Research Institute, and Dr. Erica Hamilton from the Sarah Cannon Research Institute. Here are the disclosures of the faculty, and as is usually the case in CME programs, we will be talking about non-approved agents and regimens tonight. So please consult package inserts for more specific information. So we're going to jump in. We're going to talk mainly about metastatic breast cancer, but we may sneak in a few other issues, particularly things related to being presented at the meeting. Super excited to hear what you have to hear about about the Patina trial. We had Sarah Hurvitz sitting down on the end of the panel last night. I didn't even realize she was going to do the discussion. And question came in from the audience, what about endocrine therapy of HER2-positive disease? And she was like kind of lukewarm on it. So I was amazed when she did this. I think she said she was up 12, 1 o'clock thinking about it. And I was amazed. We'll try to sneak in. Ian's going to show some of the slides, and we'll chat a little bit about that as well. So just to get started, I know people are coming in from the session, but We like to kind of just take a deep breath before we get started, before we start rocking through all the data and the cases, et cetera. And just take a breath and think about our topic tonight of metastatic breast cancer, Erica. And this is actually, we've been doing a lot of webinars since the beginning of the pandemic. And just last month, we actually did one for patients. We're going to do a parallel one for oncologists. And to do this, we work with Lisa Carey, Rita Nanda. We actually did video interviews with eight patients, women, with metastatic breast cancer. And we spent quite a bit of time talking to them, really trying to find out what the questions were that they had, that they wanted to hear the faculty discuss. It was really an interesting experience. So I just want to start out and just give each faculty person a chance to just say whatever they want to say about the scenario of the woman with newly diagnosed metastatic disease. Erica, some of these women are de novo. Many others have had adjuvant therapy. A couple of these patients, bitterly complained that they thought they had been cured. They went through all the adjuvant therapy, et cetera. I like to think in oncology, I think about this idea of the bond that heals. It kind of goes beyond whether you can get rid of the cancer. The relationship that oncology healthcare professionals, including oncologists, have with patients and how valuable it is to patients. Just any thoughts? I think one of the first cases we're presenting here today starts out 32-year-old woman with a 10-year-old, child. Any thoughts, Erica, about some of the things that go through your mind as you're about to walk into the room of a patient, maybe you know or don't know, with metastatic breast cancer?
Yeah, I guess the first thing that comes to my mind is really that, the overwhelming emotion, however that comes out, is really fear, right? So to kind of, let somebody know that you're going to partner with them, that you're not going to keep things from them, that you're going to be transparent, for them to kind of, set with you what they want to know, what their priorities are. I think just kind of level setting the relationship sometimes can be quite helpful.
Joyce, any thoughts?
Yeah, I guess the thing is that you have to be very honest. I always have to talk about median survival. You have to really be honest. However, I really think it's very, very important. You gotta throw them a lifeline. You gotta say, let's talk about what are our goals here. We want to get you into, we want you to be free, free of progression for years. We try, because some people do that. You have to give them that lifeline.
Any thoughts, Kevin? The idea of goals and how they might change in a patient who's grasping what they're involved with. Also, the issue, again, of dealing with a patient who's maybe going through a difficult time with adjuvant therapy yet, in spite of that, has recurrent disease.
Yeah, two things. So one, I think, one of the reasons that I suspect others here went into, breast medical oncology is just, you know, having seen like my mentor, my clinical mentor, Jack Urban, like I saw those relationships that he had with patients and followed patients from when they had early stage to when they were metastatic, you know, patients over a long period of time. And I think the other thing is just what you kind of were alluding to is also that things change over time, where somebody is when the time that they are newly diagnosed to where their mind may be and then what their priorities are may be different a year in or, you know, several lines later. And so it's a conversation that's fluid.
Sarah, any thoughts? And also the issue of where clinical research fits in and how that comes into the equation. We're going to talk tonight, and we actually have Erica talking about the issue of accrual to clinical trials. Sometimes you see people go from trial to trial and, you know, do really well. But any thoughts in general about some of the things you think about as you're dealing with a woman who's dealing with metastatic disease for the first time?
Well, I'll say my mother-in-law, unfortunately, went through metastatic breast cancer for years, and that happened before I became an oncologist. And I think that's influenced me a lot because I saw that journey where there's so much uncertainty about your future. Every scan, there's that anxiety that comes. You don't know if you're going to see your kids get married, see them have grandchildren. You just don't know about the future. And I think that it has such an impact on someone's life. And I will say, I think one of the best things we can do as an oncologist is partner with that patient and, you know, live with them through that uncertainty. But along that journey, I think it is important to make sure that we are constantly discussing options and letting them be part of that therapeutic decision making. And part of that is thinking about clinical trials along the journey. I think of it as maybe just opening up more options for patients along that journey. And that's the way I try to present it is, you know, I think we have a sort of menu, if you will, of choices that we take along the journey through the disease. But if we can open up and extend the options on that menu and potentially get access to new drugs that could be even better than some of our standard choices, it's a really nice thing. And I think, you know, patients are really so open to that and give so much when they participate in trials.
And patients value so much the oncology team. I mean, it really, the value that you provide to them, so amazing, really. And finally, Ian, you know, I also think, you know, a lot of people who attend our events or listen to our programs are new to oncology. We have a lot of fellows. What are some of the things that you think about or maybe you bring up and people are new to oncology about this scenario and some of the issues that come up?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's all the things that we just talked about. I think it's being transparent with patients. Honestly, in terms of numbers, I actually don't volunteer, you know, median numbers, you know, timelines, unless patients ask. If they ask, I certainly say that, but talk about the heterogeneity of the disease and that there are some patients who do very well and some patients who don't do as well. But I think, you know, having that, you know, being transparent, building that, you know, taking advantage of the long-term relationship we've had, I think is really important. And, you know, I think one of the nice things about being a fellow is you can work with different oncologists in the clinic and see how we all interact differently with our patients, and there's no one right way, but in each fellow, you know, figures out what works best for them. But, you know, again, I think it's transparency, it's listening to patients, understanding their expectations, and making sure they know that you're going to be with them the whole time, you know, regardless of what happens.
So here's our agenda for tonight. We have five modules, and each one the faculty will start out with a presentation, and following that, we'll hear about some cases. Some of these are real patients. Some are real patients that have been modified. Others hypothetical, sort of board-like cases. And when we get, so we're going to start out with HER2 positive, then go to triple negative. But then we're going to do hormone receptor positive. But last night we spent 2 hours on endocrine therapy, and we could have spent 5 hours on it. And incidentally, I am going to ask him about EMBER-3, even though we're not talking about hormonal therapy, because you just got to find out what they think about it. Last night, we asked the faculty, of course, so I'm curious what the faculty thinks about that. Very interesting paper that was presented and published simultaneously. And then Joyce is going to get into the issue, and again, so important in managing these patients, particularly in the palliative setting, tolerability considerations, and Eric will finish out with a great talk on a number of really interesting other issues you don't see a lot of times in scientific meetings or CME meetings, accrual to clinical trials, complementary therapy, which that was maybe one of the number one questions in the patient seminars that they had about. But we'll start out talking about HER2-positive disease. I was thinking there wasn't that much new, although we're waiting for Destiny-09. Maybe that should be coming along pretty soon. Who knows, maybe first-line therapy. And then, of course, the PATINA trial got dropped on us today, and so we'll mention that as well. So, Ian, let's talk a little bit about some data.
Yeah, so when we talk about HER2, it almost always seems like there's a lot going on, and I think this meeting is no exception. And just to kind of level set, it was only a few years ago that we treated patients with newly diagnosed HER2-positive disease, with the CLEOPATRA regimen of a taxane and trastuzumab and pertuzumab, and then we switched to T-DM1, and then after that we used some type of chemotherapy with HER2 therapy, and the problem was that those later lines of therapy just really didn't work very well. So we needed new treatments, and fortunately, we have that now. And the one that's, I think, made the biggest impact in terms of new treatments is this next-generation antibody-drug conjugate, trastuzumab deruxtecan, or T-DXd, which differs from T-DM1 in that it's got a more potent payload, there's more of them on each molecule, and it's got this bystander anti-tumor effect. And all three of those things make this a more effective drug. And we learned that from the DESTINY-Breast03 trial, which compared head-to-head TDXD versus T-DM1 in the second-line setting. And you almost all have seen the results of this, but we now have updated data which continue to show a very large survival benefit with TDXD compared to T-DM1. And that's despite the fact that a third of the patients had on the control arm had crossed over to TDXD as subsequent therapy. I think personally, I'm most impressed with the progression-free survival within this long-term follow-up. Still shows a four-fold improvement up to 29 months of median PFS with TDXD compared to T-DM1. Response rate's very high, and the duration of response also, I think, is particularly noteworthy, more than 2.5 years with TDXD. With this long-term data, there haven't been any surprises with toxicity. Nausea is still the most common adverse event. And reassuringly, looking at ILD, which is a serious potential toxicity of TDXD, we don't see many more cases with longer follow-up. So after the first year or so, the number of new ILD cases drops off, and they tend to be very low grade. So all of that was reassuring, and I think these data now really establish TDXD as the preferred second-line standard of care for most patients because of this combination of activity and now reassuring ILD data. But I think there's been an open question, at least over the last couple of years, is, well, we use TDXD in most patients, but what about patients with CNS metastases, particularly progressive disease in the brain? Unfortunately, that's a not uncommon issue for patients with metastatic HER2-positive disease. There's a predilection for brain metastasis in this group. And that's why I think we were all very excited when the HER2CLIMB data came out, which was looking at this then new tyrosine kinase tucatinib, particularly in patients with brain metastases in this trial. The trial compared trastuzumab capecitabine with or without tucatinib in patients who were pretreated, and overall survival, progression-free survival, were both improved with the addition of tucatinib. But what was really noteworthy was the fact when you looked particularly at the patients with this very hard-to-treat progressive brain metastases, there was a particularly large improvement with tucatinib, so a 10-month improvement in survival in this group. And the response rate within the brain was about 47%, which was fairly unprecedented when that trial came out. So I think that's why we all started thinking about tucatinib, particularly in patients who had brain metastases, appropriately. Toxicity is manageable in general with this regimen. But with the data from tucatinib, people started asking, now that we were using TDXD so much, does TDXD have activity in the brain? And there were some small studies that suggested that it might. And then we did this pooled analysis of all of the DESTINY-Breast trials with TDXD, and showed what I think is a fairly robust 45% response rate in patients with active brain metastases. So that was encouraging. And then over the summer, we have data from the Destiny Breast 12 study. So this was the first large prospective trial of T-DXd in patients with brain metastases, 243, I think, if I can read, patients with brain metastases treated with monotherapy T-DXd. And again, I think fairly robust data showing a response rate in patients with progressive brain mets in the brain of 60%. Really, I think, cementing this idea that T-DXd has activity in patients with progressive brain mets. So in my mind, at least, this combination of data has had me rethink how we approach patients with metastatic disease, still using THP in the first line. But in the past, I think the recommendations were kind of you had to tailor patients on whether they had brain metastases or not. If they didn't, you gave them T-DXd. If they did, you gave them tucatinib-based therapy. But now with these new data showing not only a robust activity of T-DXd in the brain, but of course we have the extracranial activity and duration of benefit with T-DXd outside the brain. So in my mind now, the recommendation would be to use T-DXd in virtually all patients in the second line, and then use tucatinib in the third line, or T-DM1, and then switch in the fourth line, and later you go back to chemotherapy with HER2 therapy. Now we did have data from HER2CLIMB-02, which was actually looking at the combination of tucatinib with T-DM1, hoping to get the best of both worlds with those two drugs. But unfortunately, the benefit of tucatinib when added to T-DM1 was pretty limited. There was absolutely no survival benefit, and there was increased toxicity. So I don't think this combination is really ready for the clinic. There's other drugs like neratinib, a very potent tyrosine kinase inhibitor that was looked at in the NALA trial, looking at neratinib plus CAPE versus lapatinib plus CAPE, and that also was a positive trial, but also the benefit was quite modest. There was no survival benefit, and there was substantial grade 3 diarrhea despite prophylaxis. So again, I don't think that that's a combination that I use very much. And so we're left with, I think, a number of unanswered questions. What's the efficacy of T-DM1 after T-DXd? We really have very limited data on that. Hopefully we'll have more going forward. We actually don't have a lot of data of any drug after T-DXd. So, but that, I think, again, we'll have more data over time. And is there a role for these very potent tyrosine kinase inhibitors, neratinib and pirotinib? Because of the benefits of tucatinib and the fact that tucatinib is generally better tolerated than those other TKIs, I think the question would be, do these other TKIs have a role after patients have progressed on tucatinib? We don't have data on that. I think it would be nice if we had that, and then we could think about where to slot in these other TKIs. And then this last question, which I didn't have any data for up until 3 hours ago, was can we improve upon the Cleopatra regimen of THP in patients with the first line, and then, you know, as Neil said, we had this very nice pre-Christmas present of Patina, which was a trial that was looking at patients who had the THP or taxane HP regimen in the first line setting. They'd finished 6 or 8 cycles of chemotherapy. They were going to the usual maintenance of just using antibodies. And in this patient population, which was specific for the ER-positive, HER2-positive patients, they were randomized to the standard of care of HP plus endocrine therapy or the investigational arm of that same combination with palbociclib at the standard dosing. And the results, I think, were quite striking. The addition of palbociclib to HER2 therapy and endocrine therapy led to a pretty substantial improvement in progression-free survival, about 15 months, a hazard ratio of 0.74, very statistically significant. The benefit is, I can't quite see, but I think out at 4 years, the benefit was about 10% in absolute PFS benefit, so really clinically meaningful advantage. And what looks nice, I think, is that these curves are starting to flatten out, suggesting that there may be a plateau. Overall survival, very immature, but trending in the right direction. And toxicity was quite manageable for this combination. There was 11% grade 3 diarrhea, but it's very few patients discontinued. So I think that those data were fairly compelling. That was the sense in the room. You know, we'll have to wait for the FDA. We'll have to wait for NCCN guidelines to come in. But I really do think this should be a standard of care for this maintenance population. Then we have, as Neil said, another potential perturbation in the plan, which is the results from DESTINY-Breast09, which is looking at T-DXd in the first-line setting compared to standard THP. That result hopefully will come out in the next year or so, and again, we'll have to think about how to use that if T-DXd is superior. The quality of life of T-DXd compared to maintenance HP in those patients who are out for a ways, I think also we'll have to kind of factor into the discussion. And then I know I'm over time, but I just wanted to say one more tidbit, which is that, you know, as we're seeing better and better outcomes and more effective HER2-directed therapies, it may be time to stop thinking purely of treating these patients palliatively and think about whether there's a curative approach to patients with newly diagnosed HER2-positive metastatic disease. And one way to do that is being tested in a clinical trial right now in the TBCRC, where patients with de novo HER2-positive disease are getting not THP, not to progression, but a defined course of just 12 weeks, then a defined course of T-DXd, then T-DM1 tucatinib, then HP tucatinib, and then stopping therapy and watching, with the idea that we're looking for progression-free survival at 4 years. Can we really get durable benefit so the patients don't have to stay on therapy indefinitely, taking advantage of these very potent non-cross-reactive drugs? So it's a bold trial, very well may not work out, but I think it's worth trying, and we're in that time in this disease.
So yeah, flashing back to ASH, we always thought Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors would be given indefinitely at ASH. We saw a first-line trial, acalabrutinib, venetoclax, 14 months and stop. Yep. That may be the new first-line treatment. So that was one of the questions, do you ever stop? And maybe we'll have weigh in on that. But let's get back to Patina. And Sarah, you know, the other thing about Sarah Hurvitz's presentation was, she not only, to me, opened up the issue of hormonal therapy, but just targeted therapy in general, you know, BRCA, PARP inhibitors, PIK3, ESR1. You know, HER2's kind of been, we have to prove, it's a different animal, we have to prove everything differently. And you did one of the first studies looking at, I think, in hormonal therapy and HER2-positive disease. Any sense about where we're heading? Do you think this vision that Sarah was talking about, really individualizing it to each patient, including HER2, is where we're heading?
I hope so, because I think, you know, what Sarah did a great job really showing that HER2-positive disease doesn't really behave all the same. And I think she pointed out an important thing in Patina, which is that there are people who drop off early on, right? There are people who have HER2-refractory disease. Those are not the people that ended up on Patina, right? We took people who had had stable disease or were responding after 6 to 8 cycles of THP and then put them onto a maintenance strategy. And that's why you're seeing these really incredibly prolonged PFS compared to anything we've ever seen to date. And so I think it's extraordinary, but it was almost like a selection, you know, that we were able to use some type of selection to pick out those people who are going to do well and then think about endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 inhibition, maybe because these are luminal cancers which seem to respond better to treatment. So it sort of begs the question, can we do even better than this sort of trial and error approach where we give induction and then respond to it, but can we actually have a biomarker that will help us do this? And we saw some flavor of that at this meeting today where there were lots of different, there's HER2-DX, there was ERBB2 copy number, things that seem to predict very prolonged benefit to upfront HP maintenance. And in the future, I wonder if ctDNA guidance will also help us thinking about early clearance to help guide which patients are going to do well. But I do think that's the movement we need to get to, especially as this toolbox increases, maybe as T-DXd moves into this space and we have choice who could get away with endocrine therapy and CDK alone without any chemo, who needs T-DXd, who needs THP induction. I mean, there are just so many unanswered questions about the selection.
And Kevin, you know, another we were talking about discussing with patients what to expect from the future, and I wonder, I'm sure you get the question, is there any chance I'll be cured? Or, you know, functional cure. Last week again at ASH, there's a new TKI, asciminib, out there, and now it's going to take over the second line for CML. I took over for imatinib, and of course we don't get rid of the disease usually, but some of these people are able to come off on therapy, and the others, you know, live a normal life expectancy. Again, Sarah Hurwitz was pointing out what Ian was showing, you know, the long PFS, but just in the second line with T-DXd. And, you know, maybe are we approaching a point where we'll either have cure or sort of a functional cure? Also curious whether you think pertuzumab is going to add anything, Kevin.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, I had this conversation with a patient in clinic last Thursday, right? So, like, just this question of, you know, I think it raises a few questions. I mean, even to go back to the Cleopatra data, when you're looking at 8 years, right, we're seeing patients then that, like, that tail end of the curve that Ian was mentioning, and we see that here, right, those patients, that those five-year data that Ian just presented from Patina were, like, 40% on the experiment arm were still on treatment at 5 years, like 30-something percent in patients who were, on the control arm. And so I also think, like Sarah's point about ctDNA and whether that's going to help guide us, in particular about the patients for whom we might be able to stop therapy, because I think, you know, in my clinic, and I imagine in your clinic as well, like, you have patients who just remain on HER2 therapy and are doing well really for some time, reflecting what we see the data in the trials, but the question really being, well, at what point can you safely back off? And I do wonder if that sort of approach will help yield that answer.
So, Joyce, actually, Michael, who I don't know, has been in this room the last three days, and I always starts out with like 10 great questions, has a whole bunch of them. We'll see how many we can ask, but a number of people brought up the issue of HER2 mutant disease. Michael brings up the question of, you know, how do you tell whether a TKI is going to be better than an ADC? You know, in lung cancer, first-line therapy for HER2 mutant disease is T-DXd, and you know, it works very well. How do you think through, how often do you see HER2 mutant disease, and how do you think through therapy?
Well, HER2 mutant disease is an issue mainly of metastatic disease. It's very rarely in the primary cancer. It's acquired. And it's you see it mostly in invasive lobular cancer. That's HER2 negative. It can be HER2 low. And we do know that fulvestrant and neratinib and trastuzumab, that's a part of the SUMMIT trial, is very, very effective. I was thinking about that because the Patina is positive, but there are a number of other trials in that first-line maintenance setting in the first-line metastatic, and one of them is with tucatinib. And so it's going to be so important to see with the Patina population with serial ctDNA what comes up as resistance mechanisms, because we know, for example, that PIK3CA mutations, those patients don't do as well with the Cleopatra regimen. Now, maybe the palbociclib will really do a great job with that, but maybe those patients won't do quite as well. It may be that HER2 mutations could come up in that context as well. So I do like the idea of having a menu of options for patients, and then we'll be serially monitoring. But tucatinib is also, it's in trials now for HER2 mutant disease as well. You do see them come up in the context of HER2 amplification as well.
You know, one question about neratinib, we actually have three posters at this meeting, and one was a survey that we did of investigators, probably half of you, if not all of you, were in that. But we were fortunate enough to also do almost the same survey about HER2-positive localized disease right before Catherine was presented. So, you know, we could compare how things shifted towards the Catherine model. But one of the things that really interested me, Joyce, is we also asked them just what numbers would you give to a patient who asked, how is this therapy likely, given my risk situation and the treatment you're talking about, likely to alter it? And what was interesting, and I don't know if you've ever seen this before, was there were a number of investigators who, when we asked them about post-neratinib, of course, now we're talking about localized disease, but I think it ties into the issue of neratinib tolerability. There were quite a few of investigators who actually said, I think there is a benefit for neratinib in the you know, usually ER-positive situation. But then when we asked them, do you usually use it, they said no. And I mean, they might have even predicted as much of a 5, 6, or 7% absolute benefit. I was surprised. I mean, we wish we'd asked them, do you present it to the patient? But just kind of curious, I mean, it kind of implies a lot of concern about tolerability with neratinib. Do you have that concern?
I used to, but I think now with the escalation of the dose, it's been a game changer. I gave an educational session on early stage HER2 positive breast cancer here, going through all the literature. And one of the things that really struck me, and this is a very heterogeneous disease, is that you can have HER2 amplification but still have a lot of estrogen receptor there. And those patients don't get the same degree of benefit with regard to PAF-CR or IDFS. And so there's still a great deal of risk for recurrence in these patients, and they go to surgery, they have RCB 2 or 3. There's a lot of risk there. They have nodes positive. And of course, we're going to give them and get the 13.7% improvement in IDFS with T-DM1 and hopefully even more with T-DXd going forward, but there's still a lot of risk there. And somebody has nodes positive still or a lot of disease in the breast, in spite of everything we have them, we have to give them everything essentially. And so that's where the neratinib comes in. And as Sarah Hurvitz pointed out today, there's very known crosstalk between those two pathways. You really have to clamp down both of them. And I think the data, I've always thought the TKIs are non-cross resistant with the antibody. So I'm not overly concerned that neratinib was not studied in those who had had pertuzumab and T-DM1.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers they gave us were right from the trials, you know, even more in ER positive, et cetera, but it was just the choice that was different. So one more really critical issue, and we'll talk about this again as we go along here tonight, and I and refer to it to Erica as the issue of brain mets or CNS disease and HER2 positive disease. There's a lot of excitement when the HER-CLIMB regimen came out, but as Ian was saying, then we started to see data with T-DXd. Curious how you think through brain mets and HER2 positive disease, sort of what comes first, and what situations will you hold off on, you know, sort of a la lung, the way they do it with the EGFR and RET, hold off on radiation and give systemic therapy if they're asymptomatic. How do you think through which agent and whether or not you're going to use radiation? And how does that tie into this case here of this 37-year-old woman with a 10-year-old child talking about the human issues with the metastatic breast cancer? What happened with her?
Yeah, so this lady is obviously quite young. She had an interesting course. She had very low ER, did have a node-positive disease, and had a neoadjuvant TCHP, which really is the standard in this setting. She actually had a PCR, and she did well for 5 years, but then relapsed in liver and nodes, and that's a little bit atypical. We typically think about HER2 disease coming back a little bit sooner than that. And she actually enrolled in a clinical trial looking at trastuzumab deruxtecan as first-line therapy. I really wanted to share this case to make the point that not all ADCs are created equal. I think it's very tempting to think about them as a class, but they're really very unique drugs with very individual side effects. And so what we've learned is that trastuzumab deruxtecan certainly has nausea as its most prominent side effect. We really can cut down on this nausea. We use a 3-drug antiemetic regimen in a prophylactic fashion. Do not wait for people to tell you they have nausea to start these drugs, which is really steroids and NK1 and 5-HT3. And then the other trick that I think breast medical oncology has borrowed from the GI literature is that anybody that has residual nausea, we do olanzapine, low dose, just once at night. And this has actually worked really well for my patients. So this patient did have to start olanzapine, but then did quite well.
And I see she had a 21-month response to T-DXd, and you're thinking about her climb next. Ian, again, how do you think through, two choices people think a lot about is HER-CLIMB and T-DXd. How do you choose? And again, when do you hold off radiation?
You mean radiation if she has
the
brain mets?
Yeah. We're talking about brain mets, HER2 positive brain mets.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's it's another one of those situations where we really have to personalize therapy. In my general sense is patients who have an isolated brain metastases, it's easily treatable by SRS or a few brain metastases. I usually would do that first because there are, a substantial fraction of patients who you irradiate those lesions and then they never have another problem with brain metastases. So rather than treat, with a systemic therapy and then, eventually they're going to progress, and typically they progress in the brain before they progress outside of the brain. So in a patient who radiation is easy and I do that first, if they have, a lot of brain metastases that's going to require whole brain radiation, then definitely would try systemic therapy first to try to delay using whole brain as much as possible. And in that patient, such as this, who's already had T-DXd, I certainly would use tucatinib as my next line.
So, Joyce, this is, without going through the case in the interest of time, this is also a patient with brain mets. Erica's patients went from TDXD to about to go to HerClimb. Your patient looks like they're going from HerClimb to TDXD. How do you think this thing through clinically? And what do you see in terms of response in the brain to people who've had one of the two prior therapies, such as this patient?
Yeah, because she had the Cleopatra regimen. She had a PATH CR. She presented with de novo metastatic with a solitary liver met. And so she had a CR, and then she went to surgery, had a PATH CR with Cleopatra. And I was not doing brain surveillance at that time. She had presented with a ERPR negative large stage three cancer, and I was not doing brain surveillance, and she had a seizure and landed in the ICU and had a large mass in her cerebellum and a smaller one in her frontal lobe. She had to have that one resected in the cerebellum. But then she had SRS to the other one in the frontal, and she was on the tucatinib, capecitabine, trastuzumab regimen. Tolerated it incredibly well. She's a young woman. She didn't have any side effects at completely full doses, and she did well with that for a very long time, about 18 months. Then she developed a new brain metastasis, 1.5 centimeters. I share her with an outside oncologist who switched her to TDXD. It's been working very, very well for her. She's doing great, has great quality of life,
yeah,
too.
16 months on therapy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
Again, Kevin, generally, what comes first, TDXD or HerClimb?
You know, it used to be HER2CLIMB, and I was actually thinking, I was at a meeting about like 2 years ago. I mean, it's also worth noting that, you know, both of those regimens offer an overall survival advantage, right? And at that point, I was speaking to some community oncologists, and they had mentioned that they were really utilizing TDXD second line just because it was easier to give, it was intravenous, less pills. But I will say, after I saw the data from ESMO that Ian had mentioned, I also have moved TDXD really second line for CNS meds.
Got to squeeze in one more. Erica, what about thinking about the future? Maybe we're going to be using first-line TDXD and HER2-positive disease. Sarah Hervis brought up the issue of maybe short-term TDXD induction followed by maintenance. Any thoughts about that? Also, the question came up about what about skipping chemo, you know, sort of a pertain plus CDK kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that was a really great point. You know, sometimes we kind of cringe in a way because we've gotten so successful. But, you know, my worry is that trastuzumab deruxtecan, although we're pretty good at supporting people through it, it really is chemo, right? There's a chemo backbone. And if you imagine what our PFS is potentially going to look like in the first line setting, if this is 4+ years, et cetera, are we going to keep somebody on that for 4 years with, you know, a deep response? And I think the answer is probably no. I mean, the advantage of the THP regimen is that we kind of, you know, typically do 6 to 8 cycles of the taxane, drop it out, and then people are just on antibodies. And so I think, you know, practically we will be looking for more of a maintenance regimen after TDXD, not TDXD indefinitely.
All right, let's move on and talk about triple negative breast cancer. A lot happening there. Sarah, let's talk about the data.
Thanks. So in the first line setting for metastatic triple negative disease, one of the first things we do is we check to see the PD-L1 status of the tumor. We also want to understand if that patient may have a germline BRCA alteration. If that patient does have a PD-L1 positive tumor, our standard has been to give chemotherapy with pembrolizumab in the upfront setting, really based on the data from KEYNOTE-355. Which had compared chemo with or without pembrolizumab and had taught us that pembro does work in people who have PD-L1 positive tumors but is not providing any benefit if the tumor is PD-L1 negative. And this was a benefit both in terms of progression-free survival as well as overall survival, but again, those benefits are restricted to the PD-L1 positive subgroup. And so if someone does have a germline BRCA alteration and is PD-L1 negative in that first line setting, then I'm often thinking about PARP inhibition, with the reason being that we've seen PARP inhibition compared to standard chemotherapy, where we've seen that it does improve progression-free survival compared to chemo, but have not actually seen a survival benefit when compared head-to-head to chemotherapy, but certainly does have a better quality of life with being on an oral pill that is generally very well tolerated. We've seen that the benefits of PARP inhibition, however, can extend outside of just those patients who have germline BRCA alterations, where we've seen benefit also in patients who have germline PALB2 mutations with response rates that are over 70% in this setting. And we've also seen benefit in somatic BRCA-altered tumors where response rates are in the 30 to 50% range through two different cohorts. So clearly in line with what we're seeing with PARP inhibition in the germline BRCA setting. And so I do think about these other subsets also as candidates for PARP inhibition. Where I think we've seen a lot of movement, though, is with regards to antibody-drug conjugates for triple-negative breast cancer. With the initial approval for an antibody-drug conjugate in the triple-negative setting being sacituzumab govitecan, this is an antibody-drug conjugate that is targeting TROP2 and has a TOPO1 payload, so an SN38 payload, the active metabolite of irinotecan. It has a very high drug-to-antibody ratio, almost 8-to-1, and also can function via bystander effect. We also, though, have other TROP2 ADCs that are in development. There's datopotamab deruxtecan, also known as Dato-DXd. This also targets TROP2 and has a deruxtecan payload, so the same payload that is on T-DXd. It has a lower drug-to-antibody ratio. Here it's 4-to-1. And then there's now also sacituzumab tirumotecan, which is also in phase 3 testing, which, again, targets TROP2 and has a TOPO1 payload with a very high drug-to-antibody ratio. And so we've seen the initial data come from the ASCENT trial comparing sacituzumab to treatment of physician's choice chemotherapy in pretreated metastatic triple-negative disease, where what we saw was really, in essence, a tripling of progression-free survival and a doubling of overall survival. I think these data, however, not only showed me how much better sacituzumab does compared to standard chemo, but also taught us that standard chemo doesn't do very well in pretreated triple-negative breast cancer, where you see the PFS is only about 2 months. So clearly, we need to do better here, and it's nice to have this as an option for our patients. Obviously, a question when you're thinking about antibody-drug conjugate is, does the target expression matter, and would we need to think about testing for that expression to select patients for the drug? But what we saw in the ASCENT trial was, irrespective of your TROP2 expression, sacituzumab always did better than chemotherapy, so you didn't need to test for it. I will, however, say that it is interesting that the median PFS does go up as your TROP2 expression does increase. And so, you know, I do wonder in the future, as we get more and more antibody-drug conjugates, if we'll get to a point where target expression will help us select drug. But at this point, no need to test for TROP2. But given the very robust activity, seeing sacituzumab was so much better than chemotherapy in a pretreated setting, it obviously begged the question, is this better than chemo in the first-line setting? So the ASCENT-03 trial took first-line patients that were PD-L1 negative and randomized them to sacituzumab or chemo. This trial has completed accrual, and we anticipate seeing these results next year. We also alluded to the fact that there's Dato-DXd, another TROP2 ADC with the deruxtecan payload, and we'd seen initial data for this agent in a pretreated triple-negative setting in a phase 1 expansion study where we saw very robust activity, very similar to the response rate we had seen with sacituzumab in its phase 1 testing, so a response rate around 30%, so looked very encouraging. And so it, too, is being studied in the first-line setting compared to chemo in patients that aren't eligible for checkpoint inhibition. And this trial, hopefully, too, will report next year. And then there's sacituzumab tirumotecan, also TROP2 ADC with TOPO1 payload. We saw these data at ASCO comparing SAC-TMT for short, to chemo in a very similar population to ASCENT. And I actually think the data looked very similar to what we saw with sacituzumab govitecan in a very similar line of therapy where you're seeing, again, very impressive improvements both in terms of PFS and OS. And so, you know, now again, our interest is in trying to move these agents earlier. So we talked about the first line trials in the PD-L1 negative setting, but there's also interest in combining ADCs with checkpoint inhibition in the first line PD-L1 positive setting. So ASCENT-04 looked at the PD-L1 positive first line setting and randomized patients to sacituzumab with pembro or chemo pembro. This trial also has completed accrual, so hopefully we'll see the results in the next year. And then TROPION-Breast05, in a similar fashion, is comparing datopotamab deruxtecan with durvalumab to chemo pembro. They do have a third arm there with dato DXd for regions that don't have access to checkpoint inhibition. Since durvalumab isn't approved in this setting, they do have to show the contribution of durva here. And, you know, we've already talked about T-DXd, but we also have T-DXd available for metastatic triple-negative breast cancer that's HER2-low. So in the triple-negative setting, probably about a third of triple-negative patients will have HER2-low breast cancer, so 1-plus or 2-plus expression without being FISH amplified. We'd seen a small subset of patients with triple-negative disease that were included in the DESTINY-Breast04 trial. This trial was primarily designed to look at T-DXd in patients who had hormone receptor-positive breast cancer, but did include 58 patients with triple-negative HER2-low disease. And we saw within the triple-negative patients that the data, in fact, looked very similar to what we saw in the hormone receptor-positive patients, with really a doubling of progression-free survival favoring T-DXd over chemo, and also a very impressive improvement in overall survival with a 10-month delta. But again, here, the sample size is quite small. But I thought it was fascinating that the response rate in triple-negative breast cancer actually looked the same as hormone receptor-positive disease with this agent. We usually don't see high response rates in hormone receptor-positive disease, but again, looked identical irrespective of subtype. So I think a question we all have now is kind of how low can you go with selecting patients for T-DXd? We had seen data in the DESTINY-Breast06 study in hormone receptor positive patients, and in the ultra low subgroup had seen activity that looked very similar to the HER2 low group, but this did not include patients with metastatic triple negative breast cancer. And so I think many of us wonder, should we also apply these data to the triple negative setting? Can we also use T-DXd in ultra low patients? And while we don't have any data, I think most of us think we probably can. And so I think many also think about T-DXd also within the ultra-low subset. But we will get more data here. There is the DESTINY-Breast15 study that is enrolling and does include triple-negative patients that are HER2-IHC0. So we will get, again, more data to help us address that question. So for right now, when we think about antibody-drug conjugates, if someone has metastatic triple-negative breast cancer that's HER2-low, we usually think about an ADC right now in the second line setting. I will say for most patients, I tend to give sacituzumab second line simply because we have, you know, phase 3 data for it. But certainly T-DXd is also an option in that setting given the data from DESTINY-Breast04. And we do think about sequencing these drugs. So if they've had sacituzumab second line, you could think about T-DXd next, though we don't really know how it performs in sequence. And then if they're HER2-0, I think most of us would give sacituzumab, but maybe think about T-DXd if they're ultra-low, although I will say again, we don't really have data there. So I think the big question in our mind is what's going to happen as more and more ADCs enter this space. You know, Dato-DXd may get an approval in the next, you know, year and a half or so. What are we going to do with all these drugs? How are we going to sequence them and order them? And there are trials ongoing to help us hopefully address this question. There's one study currently enrolling called TRADE-DXd, where they sequence T-DXd followed by Dato-DXd or vice versa, both in the hormone receptor positive and the triple negative setting. And it'll be interesting to see how an ADC functions one after the other with the same payload and just different targets. So again, I think this will be helpful for us to understand. So I think just overall, the general algorithm is upfront. Again, make sure we get PD-L1 testing to figure out if they're a candidate for checkpoint inhibition. Make sure you've had BRCA testing. I usually also get NGS to understand if someone has a somatic BRCA alteration or has a high TMB or something else that could help us think about targeted agents for this patient. So either chemo pembro upfront if PD-L1 positive, if PD-L1 negative, chemo alone, or if germline BRCA or germline PALB2 or somatic BRCA, you'd think about a PARP. And then beyond that, we're looking to ADCs in the second line setting, with most people getting sacituzumab, and if HER2 low, then can think about T-DXd sequentially and then more chemotherapy. But again, this whole chart will change probably in the next year as ADCs probably will move into that frontline setting, and then this order is going to get a little bit messed up and I think more confusing for us.
So a quick follow-up before we get to a really great case. And again, we have the best chat room in the business. And we got a case from Martha that's almost exactly like the Ian's case that he's about to present. But Sarah, you said you in a patient with ER negative HER2 ultra low, you think about T-DXd. Does that mean, have you done it? Would you like to do it?
I will be honest, I have done it. Our pathologist actually did start reading ultra-low for us once DB06 was reported, so we are reporting that on our PATH reports, because otherwise you wouldn't really know if they're ultra-low, right? Most of these patients are just read as HER2-IHC0, so now I do know, and I do think about it for these patients just to give them another treatment option, and I certainly have seen activity.
Eric, any follow-up? I guess the T-DXd and HER2-low, there wasn't much difference in ER-positive, ER-negative, so you wouldn't expect. I don't know if you could get enough patients of ultra-low triple negative to even study, but any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, two things. I think the real question is, you know, heterogeneity, ultra-low, right? I mean, I think, you know, we're starting to realize that probably, you know, patients have HER2 expression. You know, when we do a biopsy, we're sticking a needle in one very small part of one metastatic lesion. And it's not necessarily representative of the body as a whole. There was a great abstract a couple of years ago at ASCO that actually showed that if you did 5 biopsies, you were guaranteed to get a low result.
So, Joyce, you know, it's always, we get so many questions about targeted therapy, and yet we give it to everybody, and that's where we are with TROP2, at least right now, and we were just looking at the data about that. But there was a presentation, I meant to ask you about it before, whether you knew about it, from the World Lung Meeting in September, where they did a normalized membrane ratio of TROP2 by quantitative scoring. I don't know if it was AI or computer. All I know is it correlated with benefit. Any thoughts about whether or not, and this is with data in lung, any thoughts about whether maybe eventually we will be able to pick out who's going to benefit from TROP2 ADCs?
I do think so. I think that, as Sarah said, we're going to have a menu of targets, and we're going to need highly quantitative, probably proteomics, you know, to really sort out which patient. And then we're going to need to probably serially biopsy to see what comes up. So hopefully that's where we're going to end up.
So let's talk about your case, Ian. Actually, Martha's case is a 40-year-old woman, BRCA1, who turned down post-neoadjuvant olaparib and then developed an isolated chest wall recurrence that responded to olaparib. Your patient has BRCA1, got adjuvant to TC, then developed biopsy-proven metastatic disease, CPS of 1, gets olaparib. It looks like she had some GI issues. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that. But resolution of the cough, I guess, from the disease, on it for 9 months. And maybe you could just comment on this sort of follow-up slide you put together in terms of, to you, what this case means.
Yeah, so I mean, I thought it was worth talking about. Actually, Sarah kind of alluded to this when she was talking about how you sequence the various drugs in triple-negative disease. And I do think it's kind of neat that it wasn't long ago when someone, if Sarah was giving the triple-negative metastatic talk, it would just be chemo-1, chemo-2, chemo-3, and it was barely mentioned chemotherapy because of all the target therapies we have. It's really quite a sea change. But you know, as Sarah pointed out, so if you have a patient who's has a BRCA1 germline mutation and is PD-L1 negative, then certainly I typically would use olaparib in as my first line, and then use chemotherapy in later lines or antibody drug conjugates because olaparib I think is better tolerated than most chemotherapies, and there is a suggestion in subgroup analysis that there's a survival benefit of olaparib in the first line that's not seen in later lines. I think when you have a patient who's has a BRCA1 mutation and also PD-L1 positive, I would typically use the KEYNOTE-355 regimen first because, again, there's a substantial survival benefit there. There are data to suggest that immunotherapy works better earlier, so I would typically use the checkpoint inhibitor regimen first and then use olaparib after that. And I think that that's both consistent with the data and probably the best quality of life aspects as well.
Thanks. So we're going to move on now, talk about endocrine-resistant metastatic disease. As I mentioned last night, we talked about endocrine therapy, and I am going to try to squeeze in a little Ember 3 out of the faculty, but let's talk about endocrine-resistant metastatic disease first, Kevin.
Great. So as much as we think about triple-negative breast cancer, as Sarah had mentioned, we've had advances, though this really remains an area of focus of research and an unmet need. The same really holds true for metastatic endocrine-resistant disease that's HER2-negative. And a number of the drugs that I'm going to be talking about, you heard from both Ian and Sarah, but just to review data for sacituzumab govitecan. We have data in hormone receptor positive HER2-negative disease based upon the TROPiCS-02 study. In this particular study, patients would have received at least two, but no more than four lines of chemotherapy for metastatic disease, and at least, you know, a line of endocrine therapy and a CDK4/6 inhibitor as well as a taxane. They were randomized to SG versus physician choice chemotherapy. We saw an improvement in progression-free survival about 1.5 months, but then when we looked at overall survival, it was an improvement of about 3 months or so. You may be wondering, as Sarah was talking, well, triple-negative breast cancer, TROP2, but what about for patients with hormone receptor-positive disease? And the exact same story held true in TROPiCS-02. One, in terms of the TROP2 expression, TROP2 is not something that we check, though patients who had lower levels of TROP2, which were not quite as common, didn't seem to have the same magnitude of benefit, but we're not checking TROP2, but same also holds true for HER2, right, where we see benefit regardless of whether a patient is HER2 negative, is defined as IHC0, or HER2 ultra low. Sarah also mentioned Dato-DXd. We've seen data from TROPION-Breast01, which is a phase 3 trial of Dato-DXd versus physician choice chemotherapy. In this study, patients would have been previously treated with one or two lines of chemotherapy. So some patients were treated earlier than what we saw with TROPiCS-02. And the primary endpoint of this is dual primary endpoint of progression-free survival and overall survival. We've seen data that there's an improvement in progression-free survival. You can see the delta listed here is about 2 months or so. There are differences, as was previously mentioned, between toxicity profiles. With Dato-DXd, for instance, we see higher rates of stomatitis, and there can also be some ocular issues. The other thing is we're awaiting the results, the overall survival results we've seen by press release. There's not an improvement in overall survival, though we haven't seen those data presented publicly, but also understanding that the field had changed by that time and a number of patients would have received potentially ADCs at the time of progression. DESTINY-Breast04, Sarah had mentioned this, but I'm going to focus on the hormone receptor positive patients. As Sarah had mentioned, the hormone receptor negative patients. Again, study of T-DXd versus physician choice chemotherapy. And this, similar to the study I just mentioned, TROPION-Breast01, this is the same line of patients. So 1 to 2 prior lines of chemotherapy in the metastatic setting. As Sarah had also mentioned, you know, about a third of patients have HER2-low disease. If they're hormone receptor negative, hormone receptor positive is about 2/3. And this was the majority of patients that we saw in DESTINY-Breast04, which had been presented at ASCO several years ago and published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And we saw in all patients, including the patients with hormone receptor positive disease, a significant improvement in progression-free survival, as well as overall survival. So those are what these data are here in the hormone receptor positive cohort that is on the left, and then all patients that are on the right. And I just want to draw your attention to the bottom of the slide, which is just showing the overall survival difference, which you can see, is around like 6 months or so for those patients with hormone receptor positive disease. So this is a slide that's just discriminating the different studies that I've gone through. Sarah also had highlighted the different ADCs that I had just talked about, but again, this is for hormone receptor positive disease. And, Ian had also mentioned in terms of trastuzumab deruxtecan, the concern for interstitial lung disease. You're not hallucinating. This isn't deja vu. You might have just seen this slide a couple minutes ago. In terms of ultra-low disease, we also have at our site, our pathologists describe ultra-low as 0, and then they have a little comma next to it that says, like, with some level of membranous staining, which has been quite helpful as we've been trying to get access for those patients with hormone receptor positive HER2 ultra-low disease. So DESTINY-Breast06, was T-DXd. There was a cohort of patients who HER2 low and then a smaller cohort of patients who had HER2 ultra low disease. The patients were randomly assigned to physician choice chemotherapy. The chemotherapy options in this study were a little bit different, that they were capecitabine as well as nab-paclitaxel or Taxol. The other thing about this study compared to the other studies that I just mentioned is that this is in patients who have chemotherapy naive disease. And also number of prior lines is described here. I'm really bringing that up as well because at San Antonio this year, we saw updates about those patients who might have been more rapidly progressing on their endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 inhibition. Ultimately, across all the subgroups, we saw benefit with T-DXd compared to physician choice chemotherapy. So back to the endpoints in the study, progression-free survival in HER2-low. This is what this is showing, where there's an improvement of about 5 months comparing T-DXd to physician choice chemotherapy. When you're looking at that HER2-ultra-low population, again, this was a smaller population. This was a pre-specified exploratory analysis. You can see that the delta of benefit remains about the same. And I'm also showing you some of the overall survival data. And what we're showing, you know, similar to what we saw in HER2-positive disease, you know, we see some really nice responses in HER2-low disease as well as HER2-ultra-low disease. And so what we've been talking about, you know, across the board here is that there really is nice response in other clinical activity with HER2 disease across all of that spectrum. Previously, we were just talking about the SUMMIT trial and HER2 mutations. You'd asked the question about what's the rate of HER2 mutations. So in ER-positive disease, in the metastatic setting, it's about 8%. That rate is higher in invasive lobular tumors. It's about 15% or so. These data had been previously presented. Now they're published in the Annals of Clinical Oncology. And what I'm really highlighting here, because there are different cohorts that have been reported, but I want to draw your attention to the triplet data of neratinib and fulvestrant and trastuzumab, where we saw for these patients a response rate of about 40% and a PFS of about 8% or so, with a duration of response of about 14 months. And that is NCCN endorsed. And then the last thing I want to mention are just data regarding the HER3 ADC. These are data that Ian has presented, where we're looking at essentially an ADC, patritumab deruxtecan, that is targeting HER3 and is also linked with a deruxtecan payload. This has been evaluated in various cohorts, and these are data that are just showing the different responses that we've seen in the different subtypes of breast cancer. And you can see we've seen some nice responses for patients across all of the subtypes. Hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, as well as triple negative, as well as HER2 positive. And they also reported data that the expression of HER3 really didn't seem to be necessarily a predictor for who benefits from this particular antibody drug conjugate. And this drug is also, you know, heavily being evaluated in non-small cell lung cancer. These are efficacy outcomes in the various subtypes of disease, and you can see the different response rates that are listed here, and the PFS, since I'm talking about hormone receptor positive HER2 negative disease, I just want to call out the progression-free survival being about, the median being about 7.4 months. And then I also just want to mention that we did see data with this ADC here at this meeting in the neoadjuvant setting, you know, in the Solti-Valentine study, which looked at patients hormone receptor positive HER2 negative disease that either had high KEYNOTE-67 or high gene expression, though the majority of those patients had high KEYNOTE-67. And the response rate, there were different arms, including a chemotherapy arm. Ultimately, there were some clinical responses, but when we look at the rate of PCR, it remained quite low. It was about 4%, and then with standard chemotherapy, also about 4%. And we've also seen prior data with other ADCs and hormone receptor positive HER2 low disease, where ADCs aren't having as much PCR activity as we would like, though this is also being evaluated in other subtypes and randomized studies like triple negative disease. So in summary, in terms of the approach to therapy for metastatic disease, I borrowed and updated the slide from Ian, essentially, you know, from his excellent ASCO discussion. You know, for our patients who no longer have endocrine-sensitive disease, if you have a patient who has HER2-low or ultra-low disease, you know, we certainly have patients who have a slow cadence of progression, may have bone-only disease. You know, we don't want them to necessarily be coming back to the infusion center quite yet. It's spending much time in the infusion center. So something like capecitabine is absolutely reasonable if you have a patient who has more rapid disease, a progressing disease, or you really need a response. Then we have justification for potentially utilizing trastuzumab deruxtecan earlier, to go just to one of Sarah's points, you know, for those patients with hormone receptor positive, HER2 low or ultra low disease, I reverse the sequencing in this subtype of breast cancer, where I may use T-DXd first and then SG at the time of progression. And then for those patients who have HER2 zero disease at that first line, right now we're utilizing chemotherapy and then SG as a second line of chemotherapy from there.
So thanks, Kevin. A quick follow-up to Sarah. Have you or would you use the neratinib, fulvestrant, trastuzumab combination of HER2 mutant disease? And what about neratinib combinations and just HER2 positive disease and people have had everything else?
Yeah, that's a good question. In the HER2 mutant case, I will say, yes, I will consider it. Although I will say it's getting a little more complicated because, you know, T-DXd also has activity in the HER2 mutant setting. And so if someone were HER2 low and HER2 mutant, you know, T-DXd does become an attractive option for that patient as well. You know, so I think I would debate it depending on the particular situation. And in the HER2 positive setting, though, I will say that to me is a little bit more complicated because we generally will use tucatinib in the HER2 positive setting. So someone would have progressed on tucatinib, and then the question would be, is there any utility for a different TKI? You know, would neratinib work post-tucatinib? And theoretically, maybe it could. It's a pan-HER2 TKI. It's different than tucatinib, but we just don't have sufficient data to know about efficacy there. So I will say I haven't had experience doing that.
So a word about EMBER-3. I'll ask Joyce to maybe summarize the discussion we had in the faculty room before we came in here last night. I really had no idea what the faculty was going to say, but the question that, interestingly, as usual, wasn't really clearly discussed in the presentation, discussion by Hal Burstyn, or the paper is, would you like to use what they did in the trial? Would you like to use imlunestrant, of course, an unapproved SERB? And even more importantly, would you like to use imlunestrant plus abemaciclib, which was, I was really confused once I saw that presentation. But last night, the faculty was pro both of those things. Not so much monotherapy because it's better than elacestrant, but just looks pretty similar, other option. But I don't know what they were going to say about combining with Abema, pretty positive. Kind of what I heard that too. Would you like to summarize your thoughts, Joyce?
Yeah, a lot of enthusiasm about having an oral SERD with a CDK4/6 inhibitor, both for all-comer population to try to get away from the injections, the fulvestrant injections, and have abemaciclib. And then, of course, for the ESR1 mutant population where fulvestrant's suboptimal, we want to have the imlunestrant. You know, I think we have elacestrant. It's a very effective drug. Sometimes there's intolerance, not often. But I'm curious. These patients pick up more and more ESR1 mutations as time goes on. I have a patient right now, she's got 19 ESR1 mutations. And we know that if you're polyclonal on your ESR1, if you get up around 4 ESR1s, you don't respond as well. And it may be that these are they're allosteric and they have different folding and you're going to have different potency against different mutations. So I'd like to have as many options as we can get.
Yes, last night Seth Wander from MGH was here, and he's my go-to person to try to explain all this biology, and really, I guess we're really curious where it's going to land in a couple years. Let's go through a couple cases, and actually, Sarah, we spent an entire program Tuesday night just talking about HER2 low and HER2 ultra low. Hard to even get through that, you know, just a small part of the story. And one of the things that came up, we were talking a lot about, of course, we'll get into this with Joyce's discussion of tolerability, is what do you do with somebody who you would like to give T-DXd to, who either has tumor in the lung and they're symptomatic from it, or, and this comes up a lot in lung cancer, has non-malignant disease, you know, COPD, cardiovascular disease. How do you think about it? It sounds like this lady had lymphangitic disease in the lung when you started her on T-DXd and was, I guess, somewhat symptomatic at that point.
Yeah, and I will say I got kind of nervous because this patient did develop all these ground glass changes after being on a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't sure, was this pneumonitis? And she did start complaining, hey, I'm short of breath, or is this lymphangitic disease? And she was getting, you know, quite symptomatic. And so I will say I got kind of nervous. I did consult pulmonary. We hemmed and hawed with radiology and really felt that this was lymphangitic disease and did decide. And I had a very frank conversation with her about the risks with T-DXd. But it was amazing. She like dramatically got better when she started on a TDXD. Her breathing like was so much better after her first restaging scan very quickly. So I think it was the right decision. But I will say sometimes it's hard. And this, I think this case brought it up for me. It's sometimes really hard to know what the ground glass is that you're seeing on a scan. Is it, you know, drug-related changes from something else, or is it cancer, or, you know, an infection? And this is where we struggle a lot.
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting as TDXD came in with the pan-tumor approval. Now we're dealing with GU, GI, you know, all kinds of people that don't have the experience you do and have not heard stories like that, which, you know, we hear all the time in breast cancer. It's hard to kind of quantitate it. But, Kevin, I was thinking about that here in your case, of this patient who, I'm just going to skip down, this patient had a lot of issues, including, I guess, brain mets, hepatic mets. But what I thought was interesting, again, was what happened when you finally got, after all these prior therapies, to get TDXD for HER2 low disease, and her bilirubin was 11. Can you talk a little bit about that scenario and what you were thinking?
It's a good question. My team asks me that question all the time. So, I mean, this was a patient, as you mentioned, who had disease that progressed, had multiple lines of treatment, and then was getting taxol and had rapid progression, and was edematous and quite sick and relatively young and had been otherwise healthy. And, you know, when we had this conversation, it was kind of like, this is, for lack of a better word, like a Hail Mary sort of situation. And we dose modified, because we didn't really have data and I was concerned about toxicity. And we gave the dose of TDXD. And then I watched as her bilirubin climbed to 20. Mm. And then after three cycles, it normalized. And she went back to work. And, ultimately had some disease progression, had carbogem, and then died from her disease. But this isn't an isolated experience. Like, we've had this with some other patients too. We actually just reported, for what it's worth, a case series about this, with TDXV. I have another patient with a very similar story where you see these incredible responses. And of course we would like for longer durability, but it did offer this patient some nice additional time.
Yeah, just to dip back into what we were talking about in the beginning, just kind of curious, you could look at this and say, well, you know, it was less than a year, but what did it mean to this woman to be able to have, to go from that state to feeling good?
Yeah, no, it meant a lot. And in fact, I also had gotten to know the sister and her mom during that time. And so, her sister now works at our institution, in healthcare. And so, you know, it really, was very meaningful to the family, including the patient.
All right. One more case we're going to try to squeeze in here. Erica, 62-year-old woman, HER2 mutant. And also we had a question about P53. This comes up all the time in our heme malignancies. I know we don't talk about it much in solid tumors, but, What's your teaching point of this case here?
Yeah, I mean, this was a patient that had a HER2 mutation. I guess I'll give the caveat that not all HER2 mutations are activating. So it's good to make sure that when you see one of these, that it is one that you're thinking about that's an activating mutation. To what we were talking about earlier, she was treated with fulvestrant trastuzumab neratinib on a clinical trial. Had benefit for about half a year and ultimately did have disease progression. And this was a patient that had HER2 2+ by IHC. And so ultimately we did choose to subsequently give her trastuzumab deruxtecan.
Again, getting back to what Joyce was talking about in terms of tolerability of neratinib, how did you approach it and how did she tolerate it?
Yeah, so I do something very similar to what Joyce was talking about. You know, initially we focused a lot on antidiarrheal medications, and then we learned that if we kind of gradually increase the pill burden of neratinib, it really allows, I think, one, the body to get used to it, but also for people to get used to managing the diarrhea, and so they tend to do much better in terms of diarrhea with that.
What about P53 and breast cancer and solid tumors in general? You know, this is the big bugaboo, I think, in oncology in general.
Yeah, I mean, we've had several drugs in our phase one unit that were specifically targeting P53 mutations. I don't think we've had a big win there. It's something we frequently see. It's very commonly mutated in solid tumors, but not a knock it out of the park solution yet.
And what in terms of prognostic impact, you know, again, you know, with CLL, we were talking about huge difference. How about in breast cancer?
You know, I don't think we have a whole lot of data to suggest that there is really a difference in outcome. You know, sometimes I think it's hard when we're looking at NGS reports with multiple mutations to kind of figure out what might be a driver and kind of what might be a passenger as an analogy. But, you know, I think the HER2 mutation certainly has pretty strong data.
All right, we're going to move on now and talk. We already talked a lot of such a huge issue in general in oncology and breast cancer. Tolerability issues, particularly in metastatic disease. So Joyce, let's talk about some of your thoughts on that.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about tolerability of the ADC. So shown here are three, TDXD, sacituzumab, and datopotamab. And though they have the same payload, a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payload, they have very, very different toxicities. And two of them have the same target, the TROP2, and one has the HER2. But again, as has been said, you really can't predict what the toxicities are going to be based on the target and based on the payload. And there's variability here. For example, up here, you can have a cleavable versus non-cleavable linker that will influence how much free payload is in the bloodstream. Down here, it's shown that thankfully we have a growing number of payloads. These are microtubule inhibitor agents here, MMAE, et cetera, dolasynthen. Then we have our topoisomerase 1 inhibitors. And then down here, we have some a minor groove binder called duocarmycin, the calicheamycins. And these are very non-cross-resistant payloads that have the toxicity of neutropenia. And then we have on-target effects of the antibodies, such as we well know, trastuzumab against HER2 causes cardiotoxicity because HER2 is a very important part of keeping hearts that are under pressure functioning, et cetera. So there are on-target effects, but different antibodies will have different on-target effects as well. So I think you just have to get into the clinic and see what basically happens. But this slide summarizes the main toxicities we see with the main four antibody drug conjugates we have in the clinic, with the TDM1 being thrombocytopenia and elevated liver function test, no alopecia, the TDXD, nausea, some vomiting, and watching out for that ILD, and a moderate alopecia. Sacituzumab govitecan is neutropenia and diarrhea, significant alopecia, and datopotamab deruxtecan is nausea, vomiting. We watch stomatitis. We need to manage, as we'll talk about, and significant alopecia. So these all have, except for the TDM1, which has a microtubule payload, these all have topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payloads, but they're very different toxicities. So let's just go through some of these ADCs and just summarize the toxicities. We've kind of alluded to some of this, but the TDXD, as has been said, it's nausea, fatigue, which can be dose limiting, but dose reduction really helps. We do watch out for the transaminases, and the main one is to be watching for the ILD, as I will mention. In DB04, it was about a 10% rate of ILD, and shown here, there were about 1% deaths. I think we're better at preventing the deaths now because we have really incorporated regular screening, non-contrast CT scans every 9 to 12 weeks, and then really educating patients to call us at the first signs of any symptoms, which we immediately stop and then treat with steroids. And we'll talk about retreatment here in a second. So I think we're going to do better and better as time goes on with fewer and fewer deaths from the TDXD. But as Erica said, we do use the 5-HT3, BNK1, and our corticosteroids prophylactically when we're giving the TDXD. But olanzapine, as has been said, is just remarkably effective because patients do have breakthrough nausea 30 to 50% of the time in spite of the triplet regimen. But this is a remarkably effective, just once a night, helps with sleep, and they can take it for as long as they need to take it if they're having any nausea during the day.
Joyce, before you get any further, while you're talking about nausea and vomiting, this came up Tuesday night. A couple people in the audience asked, one person asked tonight, do you ever consider extending the interval in TDXD and people are having problems? How often, even despite these therapies, do you have people having enough problems that they say, hey, can I take a week longer?
I don't do it routinely, but if somebody has a family thing or a trip, by all means. I find the dose reduction in patients who are very, very fatigued, for example, makes a big difference, a really big difference. So I haven't had to do it. I've been able to manage the toxicities.
And just a corollary point to Erica, what about the very elderly 90-plus-year-old? Last year we had a couple of patients that got TDXD, and they had great responses, but they were both like 90 and 88, and the doc preemptively started a lower dose. How do you deal with the very elderly?
Yeah, I think that that's really on a kind of case-by-case basis. You know, all ages are not created equal. I mean, I think that there's not any harm if you're particularly worried about somebody tolerating to start a little bit lower, and if you, you know, don't crash and burn, so to speak, to go back up. I do think it's a little bit tricky as we uniformly start lower. Then most people don't really want to go back up, right? So it's a mixed bag there. But I haven't had any real tolerability issues between, you know, my middle-aged patients and my older patients with trastuzumab deruxtecan, though.
That was something the patients brought up in the program. Why can't you start lower and go up? And of course, you know, Lisa and Rita were like, well, we don't do that. But to the patients, were like, why don't you start a little bit lower? But anyhow, back to ILD.
Yeah, so ILD, this is DB04, again, it got out to about 12% with a little bit more follow-up, 1.1% grade 5, which are deaths. But now we know something about risk factors, and we know about the time course of the ILD. This is looking across multiple trials, 9 TDXD trials in multiple malignancies. Most of the ILD has taken place by about a year. You can see it really flattens off. However, it can happen beyond a year, so we have to keep vigilant about it. But age, hepatic dysfunction, renal dysfunction, Japanese ethnicity, significant history of previous lung comorbidity, any prior history of ILD is someone not to give TDXD to. So we are learning more. This is a very nice publication here to look at, to have a very nice summary of all these data here. So we can kind of anticipate and get pulmonologists involved early on if we're concerned that someone may have extra toxicity. We also know, though, the algorithm, as I mentioned, any symptoms at all, we need to know about them. We stop, we treat with steroids, and then we can retreat. Grade 1 that goes away, we can retreat. If we find asymptomatic ILD, then we stop and we treat with the steroids. And the retreatment on the grade 1, I'll show you that it's possible. Right now, the algorithm for grade 1 is to actually stop, treat, and stop permanently. But there is some data on retreatment, which I'll show you. It's the grade 0, the asymptomatic that you find on surveillance CT scans. If you find it, it's very difficult to tell sometimes what it is, but it's better to stop and then treat the patient, get her to pulmonary, and then have it resolve, and then get her back on the TDXD so she doesn't lose the opportunity to continue benefiting from it. So these management and surveillance algorithms are really key. So there was this pooled analysis done that Hope Rugo had at ESMO Breast in 2024 across these 7 trials here. They had 45 patients who had a grade 0 to grade 1 ILD, and they were all treated. They all had significant improvement. And a median of about 28 days later, which is pretty fast, they were retreated, and two-thirds had a dose reduction. You know, one-third had a dose reduction, two-thirds did not have a dose reduction. And the navy blue here shows those patients who had a recurrence of their ILD. And you can see it was pretty fast on. Fortunately, no one got into significant trouble with it at all, but that was only 15 of the 45 patients had a recurrence. So the other 30 patients did not have recurrence. They were on, they got about a median of about 5 cycles. Some of them went out 20 cycles. So it is possible to retreat, but of course it's with very careful surveillance. I would certainly have my pulmonologist on board with that. But I would always dose reduce myself as well in here. But there are some data that we can retreat in asymptomatic patients or patients that are extremely minimally symptomatic. So we've talked about the toxicity a little bit of the sacituzumab. It's essentially neutropenia, anemia, and diarrhea. Some physicians use prophylactic GCSF. I do not tend to do that. I tend to dose reduced to start off with. If somebody has very significant hepatic involvement, for example, I just dose reduce. But if patients are otherwise doing well but are having paper toxicities, they're coming in on their day 8 or their day 1 and they're not at 1,000 neutrophils, then I don't want to dose reduce. And I will add some G-CSF in for the patients. You know, the question about whether to check UGT 1A1 is one that I don't think we need to be doing it, but some physicians like to check this because it does catabolize the SN38. And the bottom line from ASCENT and TROPiCS-02 here, you got the homozygous STAR28 right here where you have a low functioning UGT 1A1. And there is a bit more neutropenia, diarrhea, and anemia, but it's not dramatic. So I think it's an option for patients, but it's something that I don't generally do routinely. So the datopotamab, which we've heard the excellent efficacy of, it has almost no myelosuppression, very little, as you see here, of the neutropenia. It's got the topoisomerase inhibitor payload. It's got the anti-TROP2 antibody. It does have dry eyes and some keratitis that we'll look at here in a second. It's a low grade and it's just a small percentage of patients, but about half of patients will have stomatitis. I consider it to be sort of halfway between chemotherapy stomatitis and aphthous stomatitis, but that is something that we do need to manage and tell patients about and probably manage prophylactically. Many of the clinical trials are doing. So there is several of the ADCs have ocular toxicity, dry eyes, keratitis, some keratopathy, conjunctivitis. It can be some micropinocytosis in the cornea of apoptotic cells. They get micropinocytosed and they can cause a little bit of irritation. And so prevention has limited efficacy so far, but typically delay, stopping, interrupting, waiting for it to improve, and then dose reducing usually will allow continued treatment. Sometimes it does require discontinuation, but it is typically reversible. But the folks at UCSF have come up with this algorithm that they're using to try to prophylax, to prevent the ocular toxicity. A number of the ADCs in investigational have it, including the datopotamab, but they are using vasoconstricting eye drops given with the ADC infusion to decrease the amount of drug delivered. Cold compresses, like we cool the scalp and cool the feet to decrease the amount delivered. To use the preservative-free artificial tears to reduce eye dryness. And the steroid eye drops can make the cornea less susceptible to a toxicity. The antihistamine drops can actually decrease this non-specific micropinocytosis that occurs that we just mentioned. So they're trying this kind of and studying this proactively in several of the trials. I just wanted to finish and mention radiation necrosis. There are published data here recently in JAMA Oncology showing that in patients who had their radiation brain SRS radiation, that they were higher risk for radiation necrosis if it was done concomitantly with antibody drug conjugate. You can see down here the antibody drug conjugates that were actually used. And it seems to be time course related and also volume of brain radiated related. So the greater the volume of the brain down here on the x-axis, the greater the risk of the radiation necrosis and also timing. If you're getting out beyond patients a year beyond having had their last ADC, it's very, very minimal. But if they're within 3 to 6 months or so, it's a bit more. So that's just something to be aware of. I think it's a reason to try to control brain metastasis with TDXD, for example, and hold off on the stereotactic radiosurgery because it can lead to radiation necrosis. So in conclusion, TDM1, sacituzumab, TDXD, and datopotamab are all highly effective, targeted, that deliver a microtubule agent or mostly topoisomerase 1 inhibitors. The ADCs with the same target and cytotoxic payload with the same mechanism of action can have different toxicities. We see that very clearly between sacituzumab and datopotamab. They have, the ADCs generally have less treatment-related toxicity, however, than chemotherapy. Proactive management of the toxicities is going to really be the key, of course, and we will find out, we will learn how to do that. But in general, dose reduction is very effective in mitigating these toxicities, and all of these ADCs are being evaluated or already established in early breast cancer, where delivery of the safe and effective doses and management of toxicity is especially important.
So we're going to go on in a second. I'll ask Ian what he thinks about Sarah's case, but I've got to say that Dustin in the audience here tonight says, how does a community oncologist keep up with all the new approvals, indications, sequencing, genomic mutation, shared decision-making in our breast cancer patients, I'd say in our patients in general, when the guidelines are typically 6 to 12 months behind current knowledge? All I can say is we're trying to help, but I was just thinking we're about to do our second program on ophthalmic issues in oncology.
Yes.
Okay? And you were talking about what to do with Dato, and I was thinking about what the antibody drug conjugate to sodium avidotin in cervical cancer. They put these ice packs on and packs in the nose, et cetera. So it's amazing. Oncologists not only have to know their data, they can't always get to, you know, a referral specialist. Also, we talked so much last night about, you know, the PIK3 and AKT inhibitors. I'm going to do a program on diabetology 101, you know, not about oncology, just like how are people treating diabetes nowadays? Because again, you can't always get the patient to an endocrinologist. Just a comment there. Anyhow, Sarah, so particularly interested to hear about this case on Dato, because on the other side of the street, I'm hearing about Dato from the lung people. They have a lot of questions, and I'm referring them over to you all. But what happened with this 69-year-old woman?
So this is a really nice woman who had gone through several lines of endocrine therapy, and after progressing on her third line of endocrine treatment, was found to have enlarging dural mets and a parenchymal brain metastasis, in addition to progressive systemic disease. And we happened to have a trial of Dato-DXd for patients who had brain metastases. So I thought, you know, it was a nice option for her, given that it seemed like she needed to move on to some systemic treatment, given she had both systemic progression and CNS progression. And, you know, it seemed like it would be a good option, given we'd already known there was activity for this drug in metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer. So with Dato-DXd, you know, as Joyce alluded to, there is nausea with this drug, and so I typically will use three-drug prophylaxis, similarly to how I would treat someone on T-DXd, which I find works really well. The catch is that people can have delayed nausea, just like I see with T-DXd. I've also seen delayed nausea with Dato-DXd, and so in those cases, I typically either use olanzapine or ondansetron for that delayed nausea. In this case, this patient did seem to benefit from ondansetron in that delayed setting. I also make sure that patients are started on dexamethasone mouth rinse prophylactically. So I have them swish and spit four times a day, similarly to how we would do for everolimus. I do the same regimen, and I tell them to try to really stick to it. It's hard to do so many times a day, truthfully. And I do notice that as patients seem to notice they're not getting a lot of mouth sores and tend to taper a little bit off, and then sometimes they'll start to get a few. So I think keeping on that schedule as much as I can is quite helpful. The other thing with the eyes is I do tend to have them use, you know, rewetting drops at least a couple times a day just to prevent dry eyes. And if they wear contact lenses, you tell them to try to avoid them. But with those strategies, I will say that generally speaking, I find it pretty well tolerated, and she did do well with the exception for that delayed nausea.
So curious, Ian, any thoughts about this case? And any thoughts about Dato-DXd? Would you like to be able to use it, and in what situations?
Yeah, so, I mean, you've heard about it both in the triple-negative discussion and the ER-positive discussion. I think the triple-negative data look, albeit relatively smaller sample size, look quite promising. We saw patients have responses after they had already progressed on sacituzumab. So I think I'm really looking forward to the data in triple-negative disease. We saw the data that Kevin presented in the TROPION-01 study that, you know, clearly active drug, but I think compared to T-DXd right now for the similar population, T-DXd looks more active in the HER2 lows. I think it's clearly a drug that's going to be, that I'm almost certain will have benefit in the triple-negative disease setting. probably will get approved in ER positive disease as well, but it's just going to be a little harder, I think, to figure out exactly how to use it when you're going to have three ADCs available in that population. And you know, how do you sequence them? They all have topo one inhibitor payloads. We're just going to, you know, hopefully data from the trial that Sarah mentioned, looking at sequencing these different ADCs, will be helpful.
I'd love to ask people like Erica for their thoughts on sequencing ADCs. Do you want to change the payload? Do you want to change the target? You know, every solid tumor now we talk about ADCs, and everybody has their own views on this. What are yours?
Yeah, I think everyone has their own views because we don't have really great answers to that. So far, it looks like it's probably a little bit more important to change the target than the payload. I think in an ideal world, all of you that are developing novel antibody drug conjugates, it'd be great to have both be different. You know, another comment to Ian's great points around Dato is that the schedule is different, right? Dato is once every 3 weeks and sacituzumab is day one, day eight. And so I do have patients that are very rural, that are very far away from providers, that have trouble with that day eight, have trouble with growth factors. And so that may be an advantage for some patients. But, you know, I think, you know, as we were saying earlier about the ER agents, it's nice to have options.
So, Joyce, we have like a little research to practice inside joke on when we do webinars on how long it's going to take before somebody starts asking about ctDNA, mm-hmm. which, of course, didn't take very long here at all. But what about in breast cancer? Obviously, colorectal cancer is, you know, really becoming part of standard of care. Where in general are we with ctDNA and with breast cancer, both in the localized setting, the oligometastatic setting, stage 4 NED, and metastatic setting?
Well, there's the ctDNA that finds us targets for treatment, and those, I think we are serially monitoring them. There's more and more things we're finding. I just found a TMB in an invasive lobular of 57.
Wow.
She was 10th line, and you cannot believe
no.
the response
Pembro?
To Pembro. It goes, the tumor marker goes down 75% every time she comes in 6 weeks.
Crazy.
10th
wow.
line. Unbelievable. Now, I would never have known that without, you know, serial CT DNA. So I think we're all monitoring for targets. With regard to the MRD,
yeah, that's what
the molecular minimal residual disease, I think we've heard at this meeting very clearly stated that really outside of a clinical trial, and most of us are discouraged, you know, we're discouraging. Patients bring it up all the time. Now, having said that, there are times when we're trying to see if we can stop therapy. We have in the HER2 positive sometimes, or triple negative more often. And many of us will get some serial MRD assay, ctDNA, and if the patient remains negative, that's a good sign, you know. That's not a guarantee that stopping she's going to be okay, but it's just a way to provide a little extra reassurance. So I am using it in that setting when I want to stop therapy. But outside of that, outside of a trial, I'm not really using MRD assays.
I got to ask you also, I mean, we get so tied up with our program, sometimes I'm not sure when things are being presented, but NSABP-B59 hasn't been presented yet, right? The localized
no.
triple negative 522, but with
right.
atezo,
tomorrow.
Right? That's
right.
Tomorrow?
B59 yeah. tomorrow, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And do we know what it shows?
Yes.
Yeah.
We can't say.
You know, but you can't say. Well, I guess it'd be reassuring if it's similar, but we'll see. Atezo, whether it's as good. One more question coming back to Kevin. Leptomeningeal disease, both HER2 positive and HER2 negative. TDXD, ADCs, what do we know about that?
Yeah, you know, I think just to go to SG for a moment, you know, we're still trying to have prospective data demonstrating that it has CNS activity. You know, there's an ongoing SWOG study that's taken some time to enroll. It's only about 50 patients or so for CNS, but it's not specifically for lepto. And so hopefully we'll have some prospective study. You know, we've talked about data that we have in terms of her two ADCs like TDXD and its CNS activity. I mean, I certainly have seen some responses, but I think in general, and you know, this remains a huge issue for us in our research portfolio, is that a number of studies exclude lepto, and so it's based on anecdotal experience, and so it does seem like there is some activity. It's just, you know, still remains an unmet need.
So Ian has a case of a 52-year-old high school teacher, and again, sort of cutting to the point of the case, she gets put on TDXD, has a response. And incidentally, you said this patient was COVID, and maybe we can talk a little bit about this, but one thing I did want to ask, which we brought up the other night, is how do you feel about using TDXD in somebody who's had COVID? And does it matter how bad the COVID is? But anyhow, this lady was COVID negative. What happened with her after 5 months after a TDXD, Ian?
This was kind of a typical case, like Joyce was talking about. She had good response to the TDXD, was doing well, and then, as part of the routine restaging, was noted to have some ground glass opacities, and completely asymptomatic, had her worked up by pulmonary. They agreed that this was TDXD pneumonitis, so it was grade one, as it was asymptomatic, and based on the kind of data that Joyce was talking about, the recommendations are to consider using steroids in grade one patients. I typically do use it because I'm trying to get the pneumonitis resolved as fast as possible so that we can restart an active drug. And so that's what happened with her. She had resolution. We restarted at the same dose because she resolved so quickly and then did well on TDXD. I can't remember exactly how many more cycles. But was able to continue on the drug that was controlling her cancer well. And I think, as Joy showed, we have this pooled analysis that clearly shows in a substantial number of patients, they can get, at least on average, 5 more cycles of treatment. And some patients, 20%, are able to stay on it, for a year. So it's clearly worth screening the patients and considering re-challenging them because many patients do well. And there were patients who, had re-challenged, did well for a little while, had recurrence of their grade one, stopped the drug, it went away, and we restarted again. And so we can keep people on for a while, even if they have recurrence.
So I hadn't thought too much about this issue of COVID. We had a case Tuesday night of a patient who became COVID positive. It was asymptomatic, relatively asymptomatic on TDXD. What do you do, Ian, in that situation? Will you start a patient on TDXD who's had prior COVID with symptoms but then resolves?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much everybody has had prior COVID now. I think you have to, as with everything, you have to weigh the risks and benefits. And this is a very effective drug for a lot of our patients. So to rule out this drug because of a potential risk, I don't think it's probably in most patients' best interest. I think you just have to monitor them closely, like we do all of our patients, and just be aware that there is a risk. But in the vast majority of patients, even if they get ILD, it's manageable.
So I'm really grateful for Erica taking the time to put together this talk on a bunch of things that we don't always talk about, but I'd like to tonight. Erica?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to go through three, like you said, atypical conversation points, a little bit about diversity, equity, and inclusion in clinical trials, the value of early palliative care. And I think our, thinking about this really has shifted over the past decade or so. And then also consideration of alternative therapeutic approaches. And I don't know if you're anything like me, but you get asked about this a lot from your patients. I think this is kind of self-explanatory, but it's nice to kind of think about it, about why a diversity in clinical trials is so important. Ultimately, we're going to use these drugs among all people. And so if we don't have a population in the clinical trial that represents the population that we're going to be using the drug in, that's really not appropriate. And as we've seen, there are ethnic differences in terms of tolerability and side effects, and we really need to learn this information sooner rather than later. Really, it's an ethical issue as well. We know that patients on clinical trials do just as well, if not better, in fact, than patients that do not participate. And so this really is an issue in terms of access and equality. You know, I think the other thing that pharma certainly has been paying a lot of attention to is really the FDA call for oncology trial specific diversity and inclusion. They really want to see trials represent, you know, the same ethnicities in terms of population bases of where they're accruing these trials. You know, this is always a tough question. People say, oh, well, what we should do? Like, there's, you know, kind of one answer to improve diversity in clinical trials. And unfortunately, that's not the case. You can see over on this diagram on the right that there's social determinants of health. You know, certainly, you know, more of these social, economic, in terms of housing, pollution, diet that people have, access to healthcare and screening, preventative healthcare. Also limited access to clinical trials, which is, I think, is an important one. You know, there really, aren't adequate clinical trials across the United States in communities where patients, live, and it's just not feasible for people to travel for clinical trials often. And then also a study design that excludes diverse population. There's a number of examples about this, you know, excluding based on creatinine clearance or things like that, excluding based on a baseline neutrophil count. And we know that a lot of our African-American patients can have lower counts at baseline, et cetera. I think this is a helpful map just to look at. I'm glad that I know what this says because either I'm getting old or this is really hard to read way down there. But essentially, the dark blue shows where patients are within 1 hour of a program that has a broad clinical trial offering. The light blue shows where they're within 1 hour but a very limited trial menu. And you can see that there's a lot of places that just aren't even covered by this. I'll also argue that for a lot of patients, being an hour away isn't feasible in terms of transportation or their lifestyle, childcare, or jobs either. And so we really can do a better job providing patients with more access. So what are some of the strategies to improve diversity? This is not a one-size-fits-all. You know, promote and support clinical trials and community practices. I think education around trials is really important. You know, patients hearing about a clinical trial when they've just been diagnosed with cancer is not an ideal time to absorb new information and think that this is a good idea for themselves. So I really wish that, you know, clinical trials were more of a household name and talked about more before patients are diagnosed. And then, you know, communication, increased staff diversity in clinics. There can be mistrust. And so a lot of people trust a patient support advocacy organization or, you know, a provider that's giving them information that looks like them. And then this is just another slide to talk about some of the barriers to inclusive participation in clinical trials and some of the other things we can do to really encourage diversity and inclusion. I like this slide just because it shows maybe why sometimes clinical trials are so frustrating. You know, we have the best intent on trying to put as many patients as we can on clinical trials, but for a variety of reasons, this really is what we call about the leaky pipeline. Our patients are seen in clinic, they're screened for a trial, and then ultimately there's multiple points and reasons that they drop out before they ever even start. Once they start, patients can drop out in terms of retention, you know, and ultimately, you know, the number of patients that ultimately end up being valuable is greatly decreased. I'll leave you to look at this in the interest of time, but, you know, there are multiple drivers of non-participation, and so I try to really use an open-ended question when I talk to these patients about, you know, I've told you about a clinical trial. What worries you about that? Because you'll get a lot of very different answers. What worries one person is completely not the thing that worries somebody else. And really just be very open and transparent. You know, there's a little bit of a misconception. I think a lot of people don't offer patients a trial. They assume they don't have the resources or that they won't want to participate or that they aren't going to have trust in the system. You know, a lot of people will say that, you know, African-American patients are less likely to participate in clinical trials, but the data actually does not back that up. They're equally likely to participate in clinical trials when they're offered. The reality is they're offered clinical trials less likely. So that really, you know, the responsibility lies with us on that. So again, a system level interface, the design of clinical trials, eligibility criteria that's practical, keeping patient burden in mind, and also providing necessary tools to the sites to increase diversity.
Before you go on, just a quick question to Sarah. So last Friday when we were at ASH, one of the six meetings we did was on myeloma, and we had your colleague down the hall, Paul Richardson of myeloma fame, and he did the big, you know, plenary presentation a couple years ago in the determination trial of transplant. And they found that the African-American patients, the benefit was, you know, in the total population, they saw great disease-free benefit, but not in the African-American patients. And it actually is not access. It turns out they think it's maybe biologic related to Duffy Knoll, whatever. I don't know if you ever talked to him about it. And just one other thing I thought was interesting that he told me was, one of the ways they did this is, unlike most phase three trials, 19% of these patients were African-American. And I said, how did you do that? And he said, we got African-American oncologists. Any thoughts?
I will say, you know, Erica brought up this point that I think we're now becoming more and more cognizant of how important it is to make sure that diversity is a priority in trial enrollment, because as you're pointing out, it really, we don't understand how drugs work unless we've tested them in a broad, you know, population, because it can have differential effect. Maybe there are different ways people metabolize drugs. There can be biological differences in tumors, and we do need to address it. And, you know, I think there's a lot of different strategies for how to do this that are out there. One is to think about sites that may have more diverse patient populations. There's certainly regions where you're going to be able to enroll more diverse patients than at other sites where you may not have that. But I think you bring up the point that, you know, there's a lot of mistrust in our system. I think a patient who may see a physician that's more like them may have more trust and may make it easier to communicate about a clinical trial, and they feel like it's the right thing for them. So, you know, we also do need more diverse physicians, too.
So palliative care, we also asked you to talk about. You know, we saw the recent plenary presentation at ASCO follow-up on palliative care. You know, in the past, the lung people had shown palliative care improved survival, you know, which maybe not biologic, but whatever the reason. And now I think our vision of palliative care is much broader. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I like this slide because it talks about curative care and palliative care both happening at the same time. And this is a little bit of a continuum. Earlier in the disease, they may need very little palliative care, and the emphasis is really about curative. But at some point, this shifts. And I think, you know, we have historically thought about palliative care as kind of being hospice end-of-life care, and that's really not the case. We have palliative care in our clinic. It's exceedingly helpful in terms of side effect management for patient, goals, support for the family, et cetera. And then it's also a more natural transition as they do need more support, which I think is really helpful. So, you know, you already mentioned this, but kind of early randomized trial of palliative care, really integrative studies in which patients were routinely referred to a specialist for palliative care physician early in the trajectory. And both of these studies, whether we talk about the ENABLE study or the second study, resulted in positive outcomes, essentially improvements in quality of life that led to guideline and practice change. And so we really talk about palliative care symptom care in our clinic. And I think that this is one of the things that we really have to educate our patients about. You know, that we want to involve these teams sooner, and it doesn't mean that we're not going to be treating him. It doesn't mean that we think that they're dying within the next month, but that really we found this to be quite helpful for our patients. And so again, now this is in ASCO guidelines. I want to emphasize here, suggesting that palliative care should be offered early in the disease course, not just at the end. And so this is just a slide showing some of the benefits of palliative care. Certainly the physical symptoms, managing the side effects of treatment, like Joyce's talk about ADCs, there's certainly a lot of them. And sometimes in our visit, we simply just don't get to all of those side effects that the patient is having. And our palliative care colleagues in our clinic are very helpful with this. Medical decision-making, understanding illness, support services in the community can be really helpful as well. So really just educating patients and caregivers that palliative care is not necessarily end-of-life care, really providing this as part of our medical training. I think a lot of the younger physicians coming out of training are really working in models where this is used earlier and can be incredibly helpful.
Again, quick question to Ian. One of the patients in our patient program actually was being treated in a satellite at Yale and was really extolling some of the services that were there. Curious how you integrate palliative care, how you deal with the issue that Erica alluded to of having people understand this is not necessarily hospice care. Also, something that we haven't really talked about that I kind of wanted to get into along the way, which is the issue of patients with minor children or minor grandchildren, whether you have specialized services for that. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, so, I mean, we have at Yale, it's a little probably different than many institutions. Our network sites see half of our patients, so it's not, you know, a small thing. So we really work to make sure that the palliative care services that we have at the mothership in New Haven are also available as much as possible, at least to the larger network sites. But we also, to the point about clinical trials, we also have, you know, full clinical trial services at each of the sites, because again, we feel it's important to address disparities, and addressing disparities in healthcare means not just conventional care, but also clinical trial access. And yeah, you have to bring the trials to where people are. Not everybody can give up work in a day just to drive back and forth, or have the ability to the resources to drive. So it's really critical.
Kevin?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, at our institution, we really have outstanding palliative care, both outpatient and inpatient. And one of the things we just talked about, and this may exist at some of your institutions, is we talked about at our last division meeting, them actually co-locating in our clinics. It was something that they had come to us to pilot and actually be with us, physically with us in, and so for some patients, even potentially on the fly, that they would see some patients who may be having some unexpected issues and things like that. And so for us, we're like, great, yeah, we'd love for you to. It really has been so incredibly helpful to scale that up potentially.
Really interesting and great for education as well. Well, let's finish out talking about alternative complementary therapies. Nutrition and exercise was another issue that patients had a lot of interest in when we talked about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So integrative oncology really aims to optimize health, quality of life, and outcomes. This can be mind and body practices. This can be natural products. This can be lifestyle modifications. And really, integrative oncology is intended to be used alongside conventional cancer treatment, not in place of. So certainly cancer fatigue is something I think that, you know, a lot of our patients face, and frankly, we don't have a lot of great tools to help them. I know it's small, but it really just talks about some of the data and the strength of that data about other interventions, anxiety, depression, certainly, you know, yoga, relaxation therapy. There's been quite a few clinical trials around this, and certainly can help patients in terms of mood and anxiety, depression as well. Acupuncture for hot flashes has been one of the things that's been studied pretty significantly. You know, most of our patients on endocrine therapies can experience hot flashes, and this really can reduce quality of life. There's been 3 parallel randomized trials in both the U.S., China, and South Korea. And essentially, patients were randomized either to usual care for 10 weeks or acupuncture twice a week for 10 weeks. And the primary endpoint really being FACT-ES, hot flash score, et cetera. What we saw was that acupuncture did lead to meaningful improvements in hot flashes, endocrine symptoms, and quality of life. Some insurance companies are now covering acupuncture as part of programming, so I certainly do encourage this for patients that are struggling.
Sliding over to Joyce before we keep going on this really next interesting topic. Joyce, what about complementary strategies, acupuncture, alternative strategies, exercise, pearls? What do you tell your fellows?
Well, I tend to go where there are data, basically, because there's so many questions that come. And we're going to hear about weight loss strategies. We actually don't have level one evidence that weight loss will improve outcome, but we know the opposite is true, that 10% or more body weight gain will decrease outcome. We do know that. So we talk about exercise. We have level one evidence from several studies now that your outcome is improved by about 9 net hours a week, which is about 3 hours of moderate paced exercise a week can decrease the risk of dying of breast cancer by about 50%. So we talk about that. I have found that partnering with patients on this is important. You know, we have acupuncturists we can refer people to. But as long as I don't think it's going to harm people, I think, you know, be kind of open-minded to it.
What specific exercise do you bring up to patient, and do you become concerned that maybe the patient would feel guilty if they don't exercise enough and then, you know, get worse?
Just moderate paced walking or whatever they want to do. It's just moderate paced walking. But it's actually 2.5 to 3 hours is exactly right. And, you know, women with cancer kind of know they should be walking. They know that. So, but it's motivating. It's motivating to talk about it and bring it up and talk about their weight when they come in.
Yeah, the step counters are always cool. Mm-hmm. All right, weight loss. I'm real curious about this, whether we're going to see some of phase 3 data here.
Yeah, we actually saw an abstract this morning presented really talking about how patients that are overweight and obese can actually have increased breast cancer recurrence. So this was the Be Well trial, really kind of because of the higher BMIs linked to increased breast cancer mortality. Be Well evaluated a telephone-based weight loss intervention at 12 months for patients with early breast cancer. And so they were essentially randomized either on the right to control arm, which was some educational efforts, a subscription to a health magazine, mailings, a newsletter, et cetera. Or on the left, they got that education, but then they also had the phone-based system. So 42 calls over 2 years. Each patient was paired with a weight loss coach. It was weekly for the first 3 months. It was bi-weekly for the remainder of the year, and then it was monthly in the second year. And this finished accruing in 2021, was actually quite a robust study, which I think, you know, that's the criticism of some of these studies is that they're just not adequately powered, but certainly over 3,000 patients here. And what they saw was the telephone and web-based weight loss intervention did lead to significant and clinically meaningful weight loss in breast cancer survivors who were overweight and obese. Despite the education in the other control arm, at the end of the study, patients on average had gained weight. And so these patients will be continued to follow. But I think, you know, sometimes we underestimate this, just telling our patient that it is very helpful if they can exercise. I, like Joyce, tell my patients, this doesn't have to be anything. You know, you don't have to start going to CrossFit, right? This is a 30-minute walk with your partner after dinner. And, you know, it doesn't have to be anything super fancy. The other thing that I think is really important that Joyce kind of alluded to was that a lot of patients want to do something, whether it's diet, whether it's exercise, whether it's something alternative. And so I find if you don't provide them with things that you do suggest and they can do, they'll find other things, and some of those other things can be harmful.
What about tumor cancer-related outcomes? I guess we don't have any data at this point.
Not at this point.
So that'll be really interesting to follow. So thanks so much to the faculty. Thank you for attending, and have a great night. Thanks so much.